This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Good evening, and thank you for being with us. It's hard to break the silence after this film, but I'm very happy to welcome Branka Arsic, whose recent book, Gaze and Subjectivity in Berkeley via Beckett, was what prompted us to organize this evening. And we'll dialogue for a while, but of course, if you want to ask questions at any time, please do. What I would like to start doing is asking Branka why she has worked with Beckett and with Berkeley. We've seen this film, which is a little enigmatic, but I hope that during our conversation it will become more or less transparent. And what I should like to say simply to introduce Branka is that she teaches English, is a professor of English at the University of New York, Albany, and is completing a second book on American literature that takes Melville and Bartleby as a point of departure. This book, I just learned recently, is a very condensed version of a very long book of 600 pages,
yes.
Is that it? Published a few years ago in Belgrade.
Yes.
And it is, in fact, as much on Berkeley, Bishop Berkeley, as it is on Beckett. And this is my first question, somehow. Can we understand what Beckett has been doing in film through Berkeley, or conversely, can we understand Berkeley better via a modern age version of a certain number of ideas about vision, the self, reflexivity, and so on?
Okay, well, to begin with, first of all, good evening, and thank you for having me here. So to begin kind of outlining the possible answer to your question, which is not going to be an archaeology of my personal interests and tastes in Berkeley or Bishop, I think it. I could start with a general reference to the situation in Beckett studies, because my personal entrance to Berkeley's philosophy was actually through Beckett. And one usually finds there a kind of a thesis according to which an obsessive problem of Beckett's is a kind of dualism between the say and the said, that is to say, between words or language and things. So that most urgent problem Beckett addressed was, according to that thesis, the possibility of saying something that's mute and basically cannot be said. Now, when I went through Beckett's literature and start thinking about film, then I actually found out that I'm sure you're familiar with it. There is always, from Murphy to Beckett's late work, there is always a kind of a reference to non-importance of speech, so that from very early on you would have characters saying, oh, well, don't exhaust yourself by speech, that's not relevant. And then a narrative or a play or a short story or a novel, would, whatever that means in case of Beckett, would end up by saying, all out, it's done, eyes are closed. And so after I saw the film, I actually started thinking about another possibility, that is to say that Beckett is a modernist in a very modern sense of the term, that is to say, in a sense of 17th and 18th century philosophy sense of modernism, that there is a kind of dualism, and that that dualism actually is not a dualism between the say and the said, between the words and things, but is between the seen and the said. That is to say that you can see what you see, but you cannot say what you see. What you see is always, and by definition, going to remain absolutely silent. That is to say, even though you see, the fact that you cannot say what you see makes you blind for what you see, because you cannot communicate what you see, there is no possibility of translation of the visible. So the visible that is, on the one hand, absolutely exposed to sight and to vision, and there are no secrets there, as it were, but then on the other hand, cannot be translated, and therefore is kind of buried in an absolute muteness, makes of it something that's visible and yet absolutely invisible. So the question, I thought, became for Beckett, how to say what one sees, and in a certain sense, that's a question of the possibility of testimony. And I'm not saying that just taking into account or having in my mind contemporary conversation on testimony, but simply taking into account that that is basically what defines modern philosophy. And let me just remind you that Descartes' discourse on the method basically established that as a criterion of the subject, modern subject, is the one who can testify that he or she exists. So in case of Beckett, who was constantly kind of split between Descartes and Berkeley, that obviously became the issue. If I even see myself, and cannot say that I see myself, that is to say, if I cannot testify in favor of my own existence, then even though I'm visible, I'm blind, and in a certain sense, I'm not the subject. That does not necessarily mean that I do not exist, but it means that I do not exist as the subject. So then the curious thing is that the screenplay for the film, the motto for it is Berkeley's famous formula, SS percipi, to be is to be perceived. But then when you start reading Berkeley and his philosophy, then you find out something extraordinary and not less strange. That is to say that even though he influenced modern philosophy, that there is a kind of a split again there between his mainstream works, such as Dialogues and Treatise, and then there is that interior vision, and then interior vision vindicated, and a curious little book called Commonplace Book, which was really his philosophical notebook, as it were, and was very private and wasn't published. And when you go through that, you find a totally different version of Berkeley, that is to say, some underground Berkeley philosophy, that actually comes very close to Beckett, especially Berkeley's theory of vision. And now when I say comes close, I'm not precise enough, because what Beckett, and that's my whole point, what Beckett here tried to make explicit in the film is a certain reading of Berkeley's theory of vision that basically addressed the same problem, and that was, how am I supposed to say that I see myself, right? How am I going to translate the visual into a language? And both Bishop Berkeley and Beckett, so I'm just going to start with it. I can talk about it for a long time, but I'm not going to bother you with it unless you don't want to hear about it. Berkeley's point is something like this. You noticed in the film that everything was blurred, right? It was blurred because it was monocular vision, right? So that was the first thing that made Bishop Berkeley totally kind of conservative theorist of vision, even during the 17th and 18th century. Because ever since Descartes, philosophy addressed the problem of vision as a binocular vision. That is to say, people were very aware of the fact that we have two eyes basically constitutes what we see the way and makes of it what we see. Which is to say, they were aware of the fact that our vision, our sight, is a kind of translation, and that we never see two images. The fact that we see one image is already a kind of an effect of translation of two images into one. And Descartes' optic was dioptric, it was called, was actually based on that, it was the whole analysis of how come that translation happens, on what conditions, how does that affect our subjectivity, the way we think, the way we think about ourselves, the way we see ourselves in the first place. So that Descartes' dioptic is all about that. And then Berkeley came up with a very, very bizarre idea. So the idea was very bizarre even then and was dismissed. And he said, well, that doesn't matter. The fact that we have two eyes is totally irrelevant. I mean, they don't care. If there is a translation, then that actually makes of the vision as sense a kind of artificial sense, which is why we cannot call it sense at all. To the extent that sense has to be immediate, right? So like touch is immediate, there's vision in that sense wouldn't be immediate, wouldn't be sense at all. It would be a kind of an understanding or thinking already, right? So Berkeley said, well, let's see what happens if you use only one eye, right? What happens is that you actually see you get a world in a very blurred version, right? You don't see forms, right? That is to say, frames and forms are kind of disappearing. And the fact that the form as such, the idea of form, is endangered by the fact that you actually see that blurred image leads you to, makes it necessary for you to touch what you see. So even though you see whatever you see, you actually do not see your head. That is why Buster Keaton had to basically cover and touch everything, so that obsessive image of his hands as a sense of touch became a kind of a solution, because Berkeley in the final analysis said we're constantly blurred, and even though we perceive things and we are perceived, we never see anything, and there is no such thing as us. There is no such thing as subject. And so my idea was that to the extent that the film, the screenplay, was guided by that very motto that to be perceived, that Beckett basically kind of try to elaborate that thesis, Berkeley's thesis, that our sight, that our vision, that our eye has to, eye in singular, has to be an organ of touch. Which is to say, an organ that basically subverts the possibility of distance. And so, and this is my last, as a very introductory thesis. So the final effect or consequence of Berkeley's theory of vision was something like this. If we do not see by using two eyes, if there is only one eye, there is no distance. Distance is the effect of basically an angle that is produced if you use two eyes, right? If you use only one eye, then you see only one point. And no matter how far a certain object could be, you're always, that was his presumption, you're always going to see as if that object was in your eye. That is to say, the very difference between I and the object, and then I in terms of the subject and the object, disappears. And that was, I thought, what Beckett was looking after so obsessively, the possibility to overcome that dualism between the seen and the said. If I, as a matter of fact, am the object I see, then I don't need the testimony. I am the testimony, right? So that's a kind of a short version of the thesis that I was advancing in my book.
Maybe to return to the central statement, and anybody who remembers a little something about Berkeley will remember his essay, Est percipi, to be is to be perceived. As we see in film, somehow it looks as if the character played by Buster Keaton is trying not to be. And what we have in Branca's book at the end as an appendix are the notes written by Beckett to explain how film was conceived on this very simple idea, but I think it's not something that any viewer would understand at the first viewing, that there is, at the end, we see a double Buster Keaton, and that there is one character equals O, the object, and another character equals E, the I, and that there is an I running after the object. And clearly the object, so it poses many problems, I think, technical and other, and I'm not sure that Beckett or Schneider, for that matter, solved them all. Mm-hmm. But one idea that Beckett adds, and I'd like to ask Branca what she makes of this, is that there is an angle, what he calls an angle of immunity. That is that when the camera, which is in fact E in pursuit, is at an angle of less than 45 degrees, it remains with this angle of immunity. But when it is at an angle of 45 degrees, and we see with the first couple, the I, or the E, is seen by the characters, and they all have this expression of horror. What do you make of this, Branca, this complex?
Yeah, it is. It is very complex. Now, let me first start with, because it goes in various directions, your question, but the kind of to clarify the concept of the angle of immunity. That means, as you said, that the camera basically, or E, or the subject, or the big other, I mean, now there are various translations of that instance of vision of possible. But the fact that that gaze is or has to be under less than 45 degrees means that there is no three dimensions in the visual field. The visual field basically appears only in its two dimensions, which was basically the first or the second thing that you saw. It was like that huge flat thing that you can figure at some point that it's a wall, but that wall functions as, you know, not something that has its depth or that is at a certain distance, but basically something that's totally flat. And in the last scene, you saw that funny little drawing of human face that's supposed to be an icon of God. It's supposed to be the face of the absolute. That is also made flat, and the fact that Beckett called it icon also refers to a kind of religious tradition of the meaning of the word, according to which icon means both the gaze of God and window, right? Through which we are seen by God, that is to say, as if we were totally exposed to that absolute gaze. Now, so the whole strategy of his in his explanation of that logic of vision and subjectivation is that, as you notice, at the end he basically falls into one with himself. So that what we were left with is just basically nothing. Again, monocular vision. I mean, so that my argument was something like this. What is it that that is to say object sees? Because you have two positions, right? That he obviously wanted to kind of separate. What is it that the object sees? And then what is it that E, or one may decide to call it the subject, what is it that the subject or God or absolute gaze or camera, what is it that it sees? Because obviously their position is different. Now, I started from the position of the object, and at some point I referred to a famous narrative related by Lacan that is famous or became famous as narrative of the paralytic and the blind. And that narrative basically tried to explain how come that the subject identifies with itself and become itself. How come you reach your own identity? And it is there that it's the third seminar, and it is there that Lacan introduced that through this story, through this narrative, try to explain what is known as the mirror stage. Now, Lacan says something like this. First of all, you don't see yourself at all. And if you don't see yourself at all, you have to be blind, right? You cannot recognize yourself. You find yourself all of a sudden in front of a mirror, you don't know that it's you, right? So you're blind. And because you're blind and because you don't see, you have to limp, right? So you're a paralytic, right? And then on the other side of the mirror, there is now a kind of a reflection of your face, and that reflection is blind. And what constitutes your ego is that happy encounter between the paralytic and the blind, right? So the whole economy of your ego depends on who rides whom. Is it a paralytic riding a blind or vice versa, right? Now, my reading was something like this, that both Beckett and Barclay basically gave a more radical interpretation of that history of the paralytic and the blind. Because paralytic and the blind is a motive in history of art that became very famous in the 15th century. So both Barclay and Beckett were probably familiar with that. And why? Why is it that I tried to suggest that Barclay and Beckett read that story in a more radical way than Lacan? Here's why. If there is a paralytic in front of a mirror, right, and the paralytic doesn't have a face, he doesn't see himself, there could be a reflection of his face in the mirror, right, and probably there will be, right, but to the extent that he's blind, he's not going to see, right? Now, and to the extent that the other or the double is blind, right, that double also has to limp, right? So it's not only that you have a paralytic riding a blind and vice versa, it's also that you have a paralytic who is blind and a blind who is a paralytic, right? That is to say, you have a doubling of those positions, which is to say you don't have a happy encounter that is going to constitute your subject, right? Nothing like that. On the contrary, you have two sidewalks, as it were, right? And on one side, there is that paralytic being totally blind. On the other side, there is a blind being totally paralyzed. So those two positions, as it were, constituted my reading of the film and Beckett. And why? Because first of all, you have, let's start from Buster Keaton character. You have somebody who cannot see himself, and Beckett was very careful there. He did it very, very systematically, that there is no reflection of his face. And even when he at some point sees the mirror, he covers the mirror before he is actually exposed to his own image. So he's blind, which is why he limps. He's a paralytic, right? But then, and that's now the curious logic, because the camera, to the extent that E or the camera is exposed to, and that's the convention, the angle of immunity, 45 degrees, the camera itself or the gaze has to be blurred or to vary according to the limping of, or its rhythm of Buster Keaton, right? So what you have is that you get another, as it were, absolute gaze, right, that has to limp, that is totally paralyzed by the blind one who is a paralytic and who does not see himself. So that in the end, when you have an image, because that could be an argument, even though O or Buster Keaton didn't see himself in the mirror, there was the gaze of the camera, so somebody saw it, but the mirror was, as it were, empty. There was no image in it. So the image that was returned to the absolute gaze was blind image, or there was no image. It was the image of the absence of the image. So that the absolute gaze basically ended up seeing nothing and being blind, right? And that basically was a kind of dialectic of my argument of how you get a doubling of the situation on both sides and an impossibility of constituting the subject.
I think in your book, what you do very well is connect this with Derrida's magnificent book, Memoirs of the Blind, in which Derrida tries to show that each self-portrait is somehow the allegorization of one's blindness.
Blindness.
But to return maybe to the very basic technological element of a film, it's surprising indeed to have in 1965 a silent film of a deliberately poor quality somehow. It was the first film made by Alan Schneider, and Beckett had never really worked with that medium, so that what you can see is something that is like sort of deconstruction of the medium as such, and this is something that Beckett would do regularly, as in Crabb's Last Tape. He uses a tape recorder at a time when he barely knew what a tape recorder would be like or function like. Aaron mentioned the fact that it is silent. It's not totally silent. Normally, one should hear, and we didn't hear it, shh. So the only thing you hear in film is shh, silence. So, but that reminds me of this question of, let's say, what is it that Buster Keaton is looking for fundamentally? Why is he doing this? I mean, why is he, remember the slapstick scene with the dog, the cat, the animals, and so on. Why, what does it mean that he cannot stand this gaze somehow?
Well, it's my thesis in my book is that both Bishop Berkeley and Beckett were very much aware of the fact that to be with yourself, to be with oneself, is basically horrifying. And Beckett was, I mean, more than explicit about it, so that he actually calls a person that habit that we call person, or that symptom that we call life. And then the curious thing was that if you go through the commonplace book, Barclay's Private Notes, that he came up with the idea that, which was kind of common in Ireland at that point, and all the way to Beckett, I would say, that we are nothing but a kind of a bundle of sensations that are not really framed very well. And so he put a sentence, something like this, in his commonplace book. The consequence of this thesis, that we are only a bundle of sensations, is that there is no such thing as person. Be careful not to mention that word very often. You know, he was a bishop. He kind of, you know, discovered an impersonal something and was afraid to say that basically person is just a habit of saying person, or habit of certain habits, you know, habit of having certain habits. So I guess my reading went in that direction. Both for Beckett and for Berkeley, the question became, well, how can we get rid of ourselves of those bad habits, right? How are we going to stop being addicted to ourselves? That is to say, how are we finally going to find out a possibility of non-living in a habitual way, even though that's the price. I mean, and the price is a discontinuity, right? Some serious subversion of your identity. So what you have here is, and especially in the last scene in his room, And especially when he sat down finally in his rocking chair, a certain theory of time, continuity, identity, and memory, right? Because he started from the most recent photographs of his past, which again introduces a very interesting idea of the dead visual field within, embedded as it were in a very mobile visual field, photography within film, so that his past was kind of objectivized, made into an external object that was totally outside of him that he could touch. That became a very important moment. So at some point, so it led to his most recent past, all the way to he was, or we are at least led to suppose that he was that little baby in the arms of his great father. So he touched himself, as it were, at a moment when he was without himself, right? Not aware of himself, and then all of a sudden faced himself, and then decide to destroy memory, that is to say, past, and to kind of suggest the possibility of living in an absolute now. And so that basically introduces a very serious problem, how to live in what we call now, because as you know, there's no such thing as now. There's only not anymore and not yet. And now is precisely something that always slips through our fingers and we cannot catch it. Now, the fact that we cannot catch it is the effect of this terror of being constantly exposed to one's own perception. So you're always kind of overseeing yourself, thinking about yourself, and thus constituting yourself. So what does it mean to basically reach the now and dissolve into that bundle of sensations? What does that mean? What's the consequence of it? That's where I thought both Barclay and Beckett gone very radical in their reading of subjectivity.
It seems that for Bishop Barclay, there's always God somehow.
Yeah.
The ultimate agency that can justify the language of nature. But to return to just the very plot of the film, it looks as if what Buster Keaton or Earl was trying to do was to empty out everything, get rid of the images, destroy his reflection, get rid of all the eyes. And this leads me to a term that you use often in your book, exhaustion, this idea of exhausting something. And you quote a very important article, at least for me, in my reading of Beckett by Deleuze. The idea of exhaustion, Beckett for Deleuze, would be the archetype of the exhausted subject. Is it something that you still consider as important?
Oh, sure, I think that's decisive. Just to explain what I try to, I called it the passive synthesis of exhaustion. Deleuze's term exhaustion because Beckett refers to exhaustion time and again, and you know he never got exhausted of referring to exhaustion. So, but I made a kind of a difference between an active synthesis of reflection, which is precisely that process of thinking or seeing oneself seeing or hearing oneself hearing, that kind of constant doubling of oneself that basically constitutes what we call the subject or your own identity. So when I use the term exhaustion or passive synthesis of exhaustion, I used it not in a sense in which it could be compared to, say, tiredness. So I didn't want to suggest that, for example, Buster Keaton was tired. I wanted to say something else. And that's where I have to kind of again introduce that concept of absolute present or now. So I didn't want to say that for Barclay or for Beckett there was no any identity or any personhood, as it were. I just wanted to redefine it. And I introduced that concept of passive synthesis of exhaustion to refer to the fact that that's what we are made of, right? That is to say, I'll give you a couple of examples, that now you're sitting here, you're kind of looking at each other, you're thinking hopefully about Beckett, but while you're doing that actively, right, there is a bunch of other perceptions going on, and you don't really know that you're perceiving whatever you're perceiving, but you are, and that is happening on a very actively passive level, passive to the extent that you don't know of it, right, so it's not appropriated, and we have that, and we have it time and again. That's, as I say, that's what we are made of. For example, you don't sit and think, is this something I should cry about or be happy about or laugh about? You first start laughing, right? And then you kind of realize, look, I'm laughing. Or there are first tears, and then you say, well, I don't want you to see that. So there is something that's happening that got synthesized, as it were, before your active or conscious decision about that. And so a very simple thesis would be something like this, that we are made of those passive cries or cryings or laughings or suggestions that find that makes us, but that we don't know, of which we don't know anything. And so my argument was that once you get beyond the difference between activity and tiredness, right, which is, I presume, the position of Buster Keaton sitting in a rocking chair, that is to say, and that's Deleuze's point, neither bed nor walking. It's neither passivity in a common sense of the word nor simple activity. It's just pure rhythm. It's just totally impersonal something that is kind of coming back to you. So when you come to that point that you're not tired so that you have to go to bed, and you're not totally relaxed and happy as Beckett never was, so that you can walk happily around the town or city, then you sit in the rocking chair, you find your rocking chair, and you're exposed to that rhythm, and that rhythm basically synthesizes you in spite of you, even though your I is totally exhausted and does not exist anymore. There is that passive synthesis, that laughter or horror again, or tears or whatever.
This would be my last question, and then I'd like to ask you if you have other questions. This calls up for me, since you were mentioning the rocking chair, the number of other texts by Beckett, later texts for television, but also Murphy, in which we have already this idea of rocking oneself to death, as it were, or to some kind of oblivion. And in Murphy, we see the hero oftentimes trying to reach this state of non-being, and there is a scene that is perhaps the seed or the germ of a film in which he sees the psychotic in a mental hospital and realizes that he is finally not seen by the psychotic. And there, if I'm not mistaken, you have this, he says, the rare postnatal treat that is of not being seen. And he adds to abuse a nice distinction, not of perceiving, but of being perceived, not of percipere, but percipi. Curiously, it looks as if, and I'm not sure what your impression is, in Murphy we know that this is a catastrophic moment somehow that leads to the death of the hero in a very difficult passage somehow, in which the experience of absolute freedom is also an experience of absolute horror. What about this ending, and how do you read the ending with the face of Buster Keaton? Some of you may have read in the recent biographies of Beckett that Buster Keaton was first completely shocked that he was always shot from behind. He told Alan Schneider, look, I made a living with my face, just use my face a little more. And no, precisely the idea is that you only recognize Buster Keaton, if one recognizes him or discovers he's Buster Keaton, at the end. And the face emerges at the end when it's almost not really a face. So how do you see the ending? Is it horror? Is it peace? Is it both?
Well, there is also another anecdote about Buster Keaton, and that's that he actually asked Beckett, why me? I mean, this is not comedy, and I'm a funny guy. And that Beckett replied, well, that's why I want you. I mean, I want people to be horrified by your funniness. I mean, that has to be uncanny. So that was the whole idea. Let's be funny if you're exposed to horror. But there is, I mean, I was thinking a lot about that structure of Murphy and the differences that one may register between film and Murphy. Because Murphy is organized and has two, as it were, beginnings or two endings, one may argue, at least. But there is the curious sixth chapter in Murphy, and it somehow happens that from the very beginning, as it were, of the book, whenever characters are faced with some serious problems, they would say, as it is explained in the sixth chapter, this is like this, or according to the sixth chapter, it's like this. And the sixth chapter is a reference to the sixth meditation of Descartes, and it refers to Beckett's constant criticism of meditations that basically from the very beginning, everything was presupposed or proved on the basis of the very end, so that kind of Descartes put there only what he already had, right? So, which basically subverted his thesis that he ever was exposed to a serious doubt. And Beckett always was in doubt that Descartes ever doubted, so that he ever put his existence into question seriously. So that after the sixth chapter, there is a kind of a change of tone and problem and a more systematic reference to passivity, so that the whole book basically ends with Celia seeing something, she says, on the margin. So it's a kind of a visual field. It ends with visual field that is reduced to a monochromatic, monocular image. That is to say, something that is very similar to the organization of visual space in the film. And then the last famous words are all out, right? And they're italicized. So my feeling was that film basically began where Murphy ended, where everything was out, everything that could be said. Then we actually have to address what we see and how we see it, so that there are no words. The radical redefinition of the visual axioms of film is also very important, because it's a kind of an introduction of a private language, private game. That's the convention, 45 degrees and stuff. So that was my idea. My book was, just to mention, organized, structured according to Murphy, which is why I have a chapter on Descartes and Descartes' theory of vision, and then I go into Berkeley and Beckett.
So if you have questions, it's the last chance to postpone the screening, the second screening of film.
Looking at his face, right? The animals don't turn away from the floor, the cat and dog keep running back into the room. Should we make something of this? Sort of the intrusion of the world when you're trying to isolate yourself, or is it just, I mean, obviously it brings a little humor to the movie also. Was it just a sort of lightning effect?
I'd say not so much, because animals don't have a soul for Descartes.
Well, right. I was thinking the same thing. The chair also looks human.
That's right. The chair. So there's no self-consciousness for animals. They are just eyes for O. But they are not caught up in the same dialectic of ECS per KP. I'm not sure what Berkeley would say about that, but I think that at least Descartes would say animals don't have a soul, therefore they don't worry about self-perception. At least for Berkeley, it's more to be perceived.
To be perceived, be exposed to perception.
Read Anka Elsie's book, which is a beautiful book. It's a meditation on the passive. So passivity and the grammatical sense of percipi, which in Latin, as you know, is the passive. So what does it mean to be perceived?
Well, that was the theory precisely. The theory was something like this: the fact that we see forms. The theory was known as Molyneux's question, and the question was something like this: imagine a person born blind, successfully exposed to certain surgery so that his cataract was removed, so that he would all of a sudden start seeing. What exactly would he see? Would he be able to, on the basis of his touch, because presumption is that, you know, the person, and not presumption, it was the case actually, of a person who was 38 years old and who all of a sudden started seeing. So the question was, what he saw, right? Was he able to determine the difference between something that was, say, solid, the difference between shapes, on the basis of what he knew, on the basis of his touch or experience of touching things in the world? Before the experiment I'm referring to, Berkeley offered the answer no. He wouldn't know. He wouldn't be able to tell the difference between, say, a square object or a rounded object. He wouldn't know. Yeah. I mean, just if you start seeing after 30 years touching objects, if you're not allowed to touch the object before, if you're asked to identify them without touching them, that is to say, the question was, is the person capable of translating the experience of touch, of forms, that is to say, into what he all of a sudden sees, right? And Berkeley said, no way. I mean, everything would be blurred. Nothing would be, not even at a certain distance. He would have a feeling that everything was in his eye. And it turned out that he was right, because basically a surgeon whose name was Chesselton performed that surgery, say, 10 years after that. And the curious thing was that really that person wasn't able to say anything, but was in a total horror saying, everything is in me. Which is to say, and that kind of proved Berkeley's theory that what we see is actually an effect of learning, right? And that you have to be told what is the concept of distance. What does it mean that it's 3 feet or 5 feet or what is a yard? You actually have to be exposed to experience of space in order to, so it was very anti-Kantian in a sense. It's not, space is not an a priori category. It actually is something that's based on your perception of the world. And so Berkeley's thesis was, you know, you basically have to be exposed to the visible world for a certain amount of time in order to be able to determine what constitutes an object on a distance and what makes the difference among objects.
That's from birth, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. Well, I mean, for example, Descartes was very much against that theory. I mean, his thesis was that to the extent that we, or because we have two eyes, that there is a certain innate geometry that produces passively, as it were, without you being introduced into the problem, produces the distance already, so that you are always already familiar with distance, and then you, for that reason, you would see objects as already formed. And Bartle said, no way, everything's going to be in your eye. Yeah, eventually. Eventually, but you know, that wasn't his question. His question was, well, that's the effect of learning. That's the effect of experience. One learns how to see in the same way one... Yeah.
Monocularity and binocularity are the same results of experience.
No.
So why is the film learning?
No, but it's not the same. It's not the same experience. For that is precisely my point. Because Berkeley claimed that in order to be able to see distance, that is to say, to be able to see binocularly, you have to have a certain experience. There's monocular vision is not a question of experience, it's immediate.
It is.
That was his philosophy. Yeah. Well, but I don't think it's the question of being right or wrong.
It's a reason to believe that it's blurred because he's blind in one eye and doesn't have exactly the...
Yeah, the philosophical question there, I mean, you wouldn't really go into Beckett or Berkeley's theory of vision in order to prove what's wrong or right about vision, right? I mean, you would read some other books. Well, yeah.
Susan?
It is Buster Keaton's eye, but that's also the idea was that it actually should be just an eye, and it is that it should be your eye. That is to say, the blurring of the difference between your eye and the eye you see. Well, you used an interesting combination of images of sound. And Aaron also introduced the film saying the film is obviously silent. I thought a very curious synesthetic translation of what is going on here in the film. There is a certain... actually a bunch of explanations about what's the position of the sound in the film. And as you already mentioned, it's a kind of an injunction saying, now you have to be silent. But it's not only that. It's also a kind of idea that hearing or the transmission of the sound presupposes precisely a kind of a transmission. So there are differences, of course, between sight and hearing to the extent that when you see one, I mean, you presume you see certain forms, colors and stuff, so there was a whole discussion about primary qualities of vision, secondary qualities. I'm not going to go into that, but that's important. And then, of course, you don't get there through sound, but the similarity between seeing or sight and a hearing is that it requires a certain mediation, that is to say, again, a certain distance, which would enable you to basically maintain your own kind of distance from what you hear, right? You can hear only from a certain distance, otherwise even the sound becomes not very articulate, such as that you actually didn't hear. And even without background noise, very often you wouldn't hear that sign. So it often happens that, I mean, you will find that in the screenplay, that Beckett says that's the only thing one can hear, but you actually cannot hear it. So I think this is a kind of his interpretation of sound.
Adjustable diopter goes to the lens of the camera person, and the other lens goes outward to create the blur. So we have all this adaptation going on all the time, questioning like, what kind of film then can you make? It's sort of there's a sense that if it's all that perception, and it becomes a very intuitive situation. It's not even a very mental thing at all. So I think he's trying to do something a lot of filmmakers grapple with, that are not trying to create like a kind of dialogic kind of representation all the time.
Well, I think, I agree, but the point is that the film is called the film.
Right.
So it's like a proper name that appropriated the whole generic thing. It's a proper name, as it were, that names what film is all about, or according to Beckett, what film should be about. And film should be about a questioning of the position of the spectator, the impossibility of watching something from a certain distance, right? So the fact that you also see something blurred basically was meant to put you in a position of somebody who cannot see. And Beckett was clear about that. You know, it's an illusion that you go, say, to a movie theater and you think you see, because seeing is precisely always an effect of a certain conviction. You know, I think I see, I believe I see. So, but what he's trying to say is that, well, you're deluded. I mean, you don't. I mean, what you get is kind of very blurred thing that actually works in a more immediate way as an emotion of horror, what I call passive synthesis, right?
I agree completely. I think it's about the presentation of something that is fundamental in the filmic disposition as such. And I think what is remarkable is that he reached this via a relatively absurd or random point of departure that was this constraint that a certain angle would allow E not to be seen, which is almost impossible to perceive, as you may have noted, as soon as we don't have a wall. It works at the beginning, because you can see the angle, and there is this tracking shot. But as soon as we are in the room, and we are not following the character along the wall, you don't know at which angle we are, somehow. So this is a convention that is a little exploded by the very narrative, but it allows Beckett, I think, to question one basic convention of most films, that is that certain shots are supposed to be objective and others are subjective. Mm-hmm. Like, we see what Buster Keaton sees, but at the same time, we are supposed, the camera is supposed to be Buster Keaton's eyes, but we also see Buster Keaton seeing his eyes, seeing himself, and so on. It's an endless mirroring of the viewing process. And so we would have understood from what Branca is saying that Bartleby is in fact an Irish man, and that what he's saying is not, I prefer not to be seen.
I found the most interesting word actually in the film, the word scarring. Because, I mean, in one sense, you mentioned about, you know, when he's recognizes Keaton, I recognize it, I think it was like wood, the back of his head, of course, when he puts the hat on, you know, you see his face, you know, it's Keaton. When you've seen that shape for 10 years, he puts the hat on, it's Keaton. What do you suppose would have made a difference had he, a la the Secret or something, used a not star, but role? Somebody unknown. What difference would that have made, do you think?
Well, In a certain sense, I think that's what he wanted here to achieve in his film, that basically you find out that if it's Buster Keaton in the end, credits are in the end, right? The beginning is... Well, your thesis is that because you know, well, I wasn't. I mean, you know, I mean, there are. It's a kind of a, you know, you know, the question is very good because it's a kind of, again, of a convention. So, well, that's precisely my point. So what he is trying to do here is to use all the conventions that he had at his disposal and then to kind of undo them. You know, because there is also the whole other story now that you raised the question about Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton was forgotten at that point. He first refused to accept that because he said, I mean, it's going to be very embarrassing. I'm a dead person. I'm buried. Nobody knows about me anymore. And I I'm not doing movies now more than 20 or 25 years. And Beckett said, well, that's precisely what I want. You know, I mean, kind of be a ghost, be spectral, face the possibility that people don't know you, right? That you have to kind of resurrect again. So they were thinking about that. I mean, yeah.
He wanted Charlie Chaplin originally. So he wanted Chaplin, and clearly Buster Keaton was a very good substitute for Chaplin, but he clearly wanted somebody who would be associated with slapstick films and silent films, mm-hmm. and the age of, you know, the early age of Hollywood and so on. This is part of film. Film is about film. Buster Keaton is a sort of synecdoche. He represents film. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just wondered, something sort of related to that,
Yeah, I guess he also here raised the question of the structure of modern subjectivity, which is obviously paranoid, and it's not simply a metaphor. I actually think the term can be used in a very literal sense, whatever such sense would be when it comes to paranoia. But it's just a very structural thing, right? In order to see yourself, you have to be kind of behind yourself, right? You have to be your own other, right? So you're chasing yourself all the time, and it's all the time you're behind your own back. So this is that's another reason why you're limping, right? Because you kind of all the time you turn your head to see yourself chasing yourself, right? So the difference between the so-called rational subject and irrational subject is just the difference between functional and dysfunctional paranoia, right? When it functions okay, then you have the modern subjectivity. When it's dysfunctional, you have paranoics. So, but to be, basically, the life of paranoics is horrible. I mean, there's nothing nice or joyful about madness, not at least about that type of madness. It's the world of absolute horror. To be constantly after yourself and not being, it's like a nightmare. It's like living in a bad dream, and that's what our subjectivity is all about. So that constant horror that you get here, that is the effect of this chase or being after oneself, is basically the effect of that very structure of our subjectivity. That's how I read it.
Yeah, and I think maybe there's this element that comes to me back from Murphy. At one point in Murphy, and I was thinking of this in connection with the question about the name Buster Keaton, They have a discussion about Bishop Berkeley and immaterialism, mm-hmm. since he's known for the immaterialist philosophy. And one character, I think it's Neary, says, oh, it's a defense mechanism, immaterialize or bust. So basically, this is the only thing the Irish can do, immaterialize or bust. Bust up. Thank you very much for your questions, and I
don't know
whether you want to watch the film a second time. Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay.